Equanimity is the fourth of the sublime abidings. Sublime abiding refers to the fact that as a concentration practice, we're actually building up the conditions that allow for a quality of mind that absorbs our attention into an abiding, so that there's an actual sense of awe and a reality to abiding within this wholesome state of equanimity, a wholesome state of mind. Sublime is oftentimes translated as well as divine, and this relates to the fact that the Brahma Vihara, or the God of Brahma, lives in a timeless state of peace. Vihara is the reference for an abode, again, a dwelling place. So as we practice, and today equanimity, there are moments when we find ourselves dwelling in the state of this quality of balance and spaciousness. Oftentimes, it can be sensed as a state of composure, where everything is brought to a peaceful culmination, again, a balance. And this balance is characterized by non-reactivity. Somebody once said that equanimity is the pause, that moment of stillness before reactivity. The term upeka in Pali, from which equanimity is derived, the term equanimity is derived, is translated something like seeing along with things as they are. So it's an active experience of being with, but seeing in an increasingly penetrating way into the actuality of something, so that it can be relative, something as simple as the actuality of yes, I'm simply sitting in this moment, aware of the actuality of sitting. Or it can penetrate deeper into the characteristics of reality, which I've referred to, and I'll go over again to some degree a little bit later on in the talk. Equanimity is also an attitude of balance and detachment and impartiality. I think we have more of a sense of balance than we do the other two qualities. And balance in this case is represented by the metaphor for equanimity, which is here in the middleness. It addresses that sense that there is a center. But the center is an active sense of being present, but in a way that is actively engaged. This metaphor for me has a deep kinesthetic resonance. In fact, any time that I might just repeat or contemplate here in the middleness, there's a sense of a vital energy deep within the sense of source that's present, and that one can almost feel the actuality of this sense of active presence as a center point in our experience of being, our experience of living. Here in the middleness, a place of presence, a place of poise. Sometimes I experience this as a juncture, a point, again, of poise between the infinite, which would be the spaciousness, and our capacity to allow for that spaciousness to expand and to expand, and to let everything within our perception expand with it, including even the sense of the body. The stages of consciousness, the expansive states of mind, and that that poise, that balance between the infinite, the spaciousness and the finite, or that which is happening, that which is being attended to right here, just the finite moment, just this experience of this life, just the way it is. And the isness is perceived at a practical level. It's just present in whatever activity we're engaging. So here in the middleness can actually be taken as a contemplation in order to feel its kinesthetic sense. As well, upekkha or equanimity is characterized by detachment. And I have a certain caution around that term, because it refers to something that gives the impression of being far away from our experience. And actually, it's something completely different. It's the detachment, again, the balance that exists between the wanting and not wanting mind, the mind of grasping and the mind of aversion. An example might be that when desire is very strong, we're not able to see something clearly, to see someone clearly. If there's a fascination, then it's difficult to see a person clearly. And it's also true if there's a state of aversion. It's difficult to see the individual clearly. And equanimity cuts through this. So the detachment is not from the object, from the experience, but a sense of stillness associated with that constant careening back and forth between liking and not liking, as if to say that that's the purpose of having a mind, is to decide whether or not something is good or bad or liked or not liked, is worthy or not worthy. And in moments of awareness, we can see that veering, that going back and forth between deciding, I don't know if I like this or not, you know, I guess I do, no I don't. And we can just see that confusion in the perception and the amount of tension that exists within that particular view. And of course, liking can turn very quickly to disliking. It's unreliable. Equanimity is more reliable because, again, it establishes itself here in the middle between the two extremes. In fact, what we're practicing is the path, the middle path, the path between two extremes. The path of peace and tranquility. Because of the fact that the tension between the two extremes, the tension that exists in between two extremes in duality is released, because in a sense that force of mind that creates separation is brought to peace. I'm not talking about ultimate peace, but there are those experiences where just that tension falls away. And that project of deciding whether or not something should be desired or should be rejected just completely relaxes for a moment. Impartiality can be confused with indifference. And actually what it means is that one sees all things as equal. Now, what that actually means is that there's the ability to attend to everything with equal attention. And an example that's given is that in the process of parenting, one does not overattend nor neglect. And as well, there's the same quality of attention that's given. Let's say if there are a number of children in the family, the mind is protected from that sad experience of opening to one child and closing to the next, opening, closing, that withdrawal of attention in favor of that which then is where the attention is given. This reminds me of the experience with my children, my twins, the last of my five children. Are set of twins. And they tried to convince me one day that I was not fair. And the reason I wasn't fair was because, I don't know, maybe I gave one a little bit more than the other. You know, I don't know if it was orange juice or whatever, but in this twinny consciousness, there was always a sense of like one getting more than the other. In fact, it begins in the womb, as it turns out. One of the reasons they give ultrasounds these days is because one being can dominate in the womb and take more nourishment than the other, so I guess the struggle starts really early. So I just had a moment of poise where I said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't be fair because fairness doesn't exist. And these little minds sort of stopped and listened. You know, I don't know what they heard or understood, but it was just something I needed to make clear for myself. And they seemed to be receptive to it to some degree. I said, I love you equally. You can tell this by the fact that I give you equal attention. And meanwhile, I may not always be able to give you exactly the same amount of orange juice, but that doesn't come out of a lack of fairness. You know, fairness actually doesn't exist. And the argument was over. I suppose my needing to make it clear for myself was somehow completed that karma, because they never demanded that of me again. Impartiality is not indifference, but the ability to just be aware of where our attention becomes destabilized and where like and dislike occurs. In fact, indifference is the near enemy to equanimity, as opposed to impartiality, which is evenness of mind. Indifference is more a cold and callous quality that is in a state of distance from feeling, a kind of numbed out state. And the ego can manifest in this state as in a way that seems as if it generates some kind of superiority. In fact, there are many people who I've met who are in positions of authority where in actuality I have found that there's no one present. There's that sense of inaccessibility, that inability to actually find the substance of the being. There's always a kind of deflection going on and a kind of defensiveness that's there in that sense of self-empowerment. And it's been a disappointment for me in the experience I've had of meeting different teachers over time, because I've had the good fortune of meeting many people who have cultivated degrees of wisdom. But that lack of accessibility in favor of taking a position of authority has been a disappointment. And I came to see it again as just a kind of defensiveness. There's also sometimes the need to assert this superiority by creating a sense of oneself as greater and the other as lesser. And so one of the dynamics that can arise out of the conditioning associated with indifference is that sense that one always feels small in the presence of this person rather than an equal. One of the things that I became aware of in my practice a number of years ago was that I had a deep desire to uproot any conditioning associated with a sense of authority. It just felt painful for me, whatever that was, that sense of needing to be better than. And I began to see the various conditioning associated with that, like the comparing mind is an example, is an aspect of that mind that careens back and forth between better and best. And the process of trying to decide all the time whether this person is lesser or greater than me in, you know, according to whatever it is that's being considered. And so I began to take on that inquiry and to open to become familiar with that need. And it was about that time that I heard a talk by a teacher, Krishnamurti. It was actually just a tape. But it was one of those lucid moments that arose out of the deep gratitude for the wisdom of just some very simple words. I believe it actually changed me in, at a very deep, deep level to hear these simple words, which are that until we understand our need to control, then the need to control creates a separation from the object, whatever it is. And in that separation, there is no virtue. There is no meditation. And what I really heard about that was that reference to the need to control. And oftentimes that need to control can be hidden behind that sense of indifference. So in the kind of unlayering of those whole question of the nature of authority, it kind of went from one manifestation, the comparing mind, to another one over time, and just being open to that place in the mind that says, oh, I don't care. You know, it's like, And just, you know, step back into that, and it's just that caring would leave one vulnerable. To commiserate, to connect, would mean that control was somehow invalid, no longer viable, needed. And so it's that process by which separation is maintained. That sense of the need to control. And on a daily basis, it's not at all unlikely for me to be able to sense, oh yes, the indifference in this moment. And then to turn towards an inquiry and to register that it could also just be that I don't want to feel something. That it may not be associated with a need to control, to create separation, let's say with another, but to create separation within myself. You know, just the inability to look at something and therefore to assume an attitude of not caring. So it's just been a very interesting inquiry across the board, just into this process of mind that needs to maintain separation, the mind of indifference. The far enemy to equanimity is clinging and craving. And equanimity is capable of relaxing the grips associated with this clinging. And I have a lot of compassion for this as I speak, because I have the image of the origins of the expression of clinging just in having had children, and that sense of the role of this particular orientation. Equanimity addresses the craving mind and the function of clinging and craving associated with the wanting mind. And so I think I already referred to this again. I will, in order to just kind of emphasize it in terms of this sense of grasping that oftentimes overcomes us. It just arises. It feels as if something is closed down suddenly. And it's an existential impulse. And we have so many self-judgments around it. We experience it as very painful. And yet, it's just the nature of the physical organism expressing itself. Because as soon as a being has come into existence, as soon as the physical body is separate from the mother body, its instinct is to cling, to grasp, to reach for that which is going to bring about nourishment. The entire physical body is organized around that particular principle. As I mentioned, there are these two wanting beings. You may have been one of a couple of wanting beings that come together and create another wanting being. Two wanting beings coming together, grasping and clinging, creating another wanting, grasping, clinging being. In the psychological perspective, there's oftentimes a lot of emphasis given to the early developmental experience and whether or not the organism was able to relax. If it was held, if it was nourished, or if it was left to flail. Because then as soon as it made contact and was given what it needed, then its entire organism would relax until that next craving attack. It's heart-rending, isn't it? That these impulses are still functioning within us. Oftentimes, it's left as a residual sense of, you know, it tightens in the jaw, or that sense that sometimes it arises, you know, where there's just an obstruction in the throat, or just a tension that runs through the body. A set of sensations, a set of impulses. And in a certain way, there's a limited degree to which maturation can occur. We still rely upon an immature range of emotions. It's said that equanimity is that which brings about the maturation of emotions, that in fact all of the Brahma Viharas are referred to as mature emotions. And equanimity in particular matures the merits, it said, that are present within the latent capacity that can bring about a maturation, and that this is an aspect of a freedom from suffering. Because we're still looking towards that what was associated with a very, very primitive orientation. That's why oftentimes the experience of anger can feel so extraordinarily primitive because it's a reaction to pain. And pain is existential. I don't get what I want. I get angry. And what happens in these stages of this little being kind of flailing for that which it needs, if it does not get it, it turns to a stage of rage. Just rage. There's a strange phenomenon in our world today of a conditioning in children associated with the inability to be appeased. And there was a psychiatrist on a retreat that I taught, and in a discussion, a group discussion at the, or near the end of the retreat, he said that he had found it relevant in his practice, remembering the fact that the baseline experience in many children born into this world is rage. And it's a kind of stuck position where there isn't the capacity to receive and therefore to be fulfilled. And therefore it's being kind of stuck with rage. So anger is the reaction to the pain of not getting. And this impulse to grasp and to take in, to want, to bring towards, and to hold until that fulfillment occurs. And that reaction, when it does not occur, it's very easy to understand. It's a very, very easy process by which we can begin to see and have compassion for. In fact, equanimity is extremely helpful in transitioning us to a more process-oriented perspective that can, again, see the causes and effects that are at work, that begin to relieve us of this mistaken view that there is a person here, even, that is suffering. We can see the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering. And because of the fact that this capacity for penetrating understanding begins to occur, then the mind begins to release its judgment, self-judgment and judgment of others. Of course this is the way it is. These are the causes and effects that are operative. Have you ever had this desire for someone to be other than the way that they are? Or you think it's funny? Well, you know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? How fixated the mind is on how somebody else should be. And how much time we spend trying to figure out how to change someone. I mean, that sense of spending years of, you know, building all of these different strategies associated with, okay, now let me see, maybe if I do this, this person will change and become who it is I think that they really are. You know, that's the kind of rationale, as opposed to the truth, which is how it is that I want them to be. I remember somebody saying to me when I was very young, you know, I'm just not the person that you want me to be. And I was like, what? I didn't even understand what the individual meant, because all I knew was that I had a really clear understanding of who this person really was. They didn't know themselves. And, you know, that sense of relaxed presence and a sense of communion and friendship began to get really, really tense. So in that tension, there's a kind of adversarial approach that begins to occur. I find this with my children a lot, that's the tendency where I can begin to see that there's something in me wanting to control. There's some fear of the way things are and the desire for it to be different. And it just winds up showing up as an adversarial attitude. So that there's a negative response to everything. Oh, my poor children. So that sense that equanimity allows for us to actually allow ourselves and another human being to be exactly who he or she is. In fact, it's a kind of radical suggestion to say, well, what would it be like then if you let go of the idea that there's some way that this being, oneself, should be, and come into a place of just acceptance as a way to get to know oneself. And to allow the conditions to be met without fear and judgment. Well, that sounds so very good, doesn't it? It requires a lot of equanimity. Or that radical shift in the perspective in just allowing someone else to be exactly who they are. How frightening. Because then, in a certain way, we're letting go of our need to control. And we have to face our fear. I began to realize at some point that when I began to feel a sense of that I needed to change something in a loved one, it was because I was afraid of that individual. I mean, the truth was I wasn't afraid, but the kind of governing experience that began to bring about the sense of constriction and separation was fear. So attachment, craving, clinging, the wanting mind is something that equanimity allows for us to begin to recognize in all of its manifestations. And the way that it relates to metta is very, very beautiful because it allows for what I refer to as unobstructed presence of mind, which is love. It unobstructs the presence of mind. And then suddenly, that degree of presence is experienced as love because it is a state of acceptance rather than of rejection. The way that equanimity relates to compassion is that with equanimity there is again clarity that the wanting mind does not want, cannot accept the uncomfortable experiences that are occurring. And so again it rejects them. It denies them. And it turns to a hardening of the heart, which leads to the near enemy of equanimity, which is pity. That sense of, it's too bad that other people suffer. You know? Rather than commiseration. Equanimity allows for one to remain balanced in the face of difficult and painful experiences. And the one that continues to win out amongst all of the experiences that I've had in which equanimity allowed for love, or allowed for that understanding that perhaps this is love, was when I was at the side of the at the bedside of my dying mother, and really with the clear intention to be present moment by moment in this process, and to create an environment around her that protected her psychically, emotionally, and physically. And specifically, as well, to allow my daughter, who was her deepest and dearly, most dearly beloved, to be the emotional presence for her. And in order to do that, equanimity allowed for a witnessing presence that began to see into the process of dying in a way that operated in the inclusivity of an attitude of mind that took the form of, yes, life includes this too. Yes, life includes this also. As the mind was witnessing and present, yes, and this too is included, as opposed to excluded, which allowed that sense of presence to come closer and closer and closer, and to fulfill its intention to see this process through to the last breath. It was not I who had the capacity, it was equanimity who gave me the capacity. And equanimity does ripen that within us that allows us to fulfill our deepest intentions. And the heart to stay open at the edge of suffering, so that we can be taught by the experience of suffering, so we can be receptive, so that we can be educable, so we can learn. Equanimity relates to mudita in the sense that it allows for that experience of becoming more and more fit to receive. It kind of moves the line back further and further, so that there is that ability to remain balanced, strangely, while one is receiving through the six sense doors, rather than that tendency to go out through the six sense doors, but to find that point of balance associated with the dynamic of life, which is contraction and release. It's said like bird's wings. So that there is this grace to this process of receiving and responding, receiving and releasing. There's that image that if the fist is too tight, then we can't release that gift within the palm. That process of being able to touch and to feel, and in that experience, be giving at the same time that we're receiving. Seeing them both as one, rather than as separate. I am a giving person. Or I am just somebody who can only receive. So equanimity has a role in our lives that we've not yet realized, because of the fact that we cultivate it in order for it to be present in moments that we need. And in this teaching that comes forth as suffering is birth, Suffering is sickness. Suffering is old age, and suffering is death, is actually a statement of the experience of life without equanimity. Because like in that statement by Nisargadatta Maharaj, that suffering is just experience. Equanimity allows for us to experience, to be open to the experience of life in these stages of life, in these inevitabilities of life. So that they are experiences that actually lead to freedom rather than to bondage. The exemplar for equanimity is that mother or that parent who is facing that point where the child is mature enough that they are about ready to leave. There was one of my children, and when she was born, I just had this image of her just kind of growing up. You know, I would feed her and, you know, put a blanket over her and sort of drive her to school or whatever it was that she needed. But I just had the sense at some point she'd just say thanks and like that, you know. That's enough. And it's very true to her nature, actually. Very, very practical in what it is that she needs from me as a mother. That's enough, thanks. See you later. And that sense of that one has been present and offered that which is necessary. Almost as if to say, yes, this is a utilitarian process, you know. This role has been fulfilled. And rather than grasping and pulling and kind of in the process, making, putting little hooks and threads, you know, sort of all over this person so that they become a puppet, just allowing that individual to be free. And it said the error of his or her own karma, now belonging to the world or to the universe of his or her own karma. That's where sometimes we begin to register the response of equanimity, bhavana, when we sense that we can't let someone go, or we can't accept the way they are, and so we offer this truth that we cultivate for ourselves, say, yes, it's true, you are the heir, you are the owner of your own karma now. Your happiness and unhappiness do arise out of your actions, and in this case, not my wishes, not the causes and conditions that I would want for you. It requires a lot of equanimity to say goodbye to that which we cherish most. But that equanimity also is the experience of seeing into the truth of impermanence, that everything that arises passes away without exception. And that poise in that process. There are two doctrines associated with the growing understanding that comes through equanimity. It sounds very formal. The first doctrine is the doctrine of karma. It's said that it is through equanimity that it's possible to begin to work with life again more as a process rather than identifying it as a person who is somehow in control of this process. And that the Buddha really refined this sense of karma down to something that we can actually manage. it becomes manageable. When I first heard this stated, somebody saying in a Dharma talk, actually everything is manageable, you know, something in me felt, are you kidding? Oh yeah? Well, let's see. But equanimity allows for that sense that everything is manageable because of the fact that it allows for us to take into consideration that everything that exists is already. It's born of causes and conditions that have given rise and taken form in this moment and cannot be changed. And that what exists in this moment is referred to, in whatever form it is, as resultant karma. And so it suggested that the appropriate or skillful relationship to that which is to be present with the understanding of the distinction between that which is reactive and that which is responsive, that which is wholesome and that which is not. Because then as a result of this, we do have control. We truly do have control over future karma. We have control over future karma. That's very hopeful. Equanimity, again, is a quality of non-reactivity. So it fine-tunes that discerning capacity to know the distinction between that which is reactive and that which is responsive. It allows for us to assume responsibility. And there's tremendous dignity that comes with this confidence that one is able to choose what to cultivate. Because essentially, that's what the law of karma is telling us, that we reap what we sow. Now, this is not meant to be taken as a judgment, because this is also an attending teaching that suggests that we not try to understand resultant karma or things as they are, because they're made up of causes and conditions that are far beyond our comprehension. And to try to understand karma, it said, leads to madness. And I think that I can attest to that. That my own need to understand has felt like a kind of madness. And there actually are views of the world in karma these days where, you know, people will try to understand past karma or try to experience past lives and so forth. And that's not that it's wrong or bad, but the motivation in it oftentimes leads to a lot of delusion. The motivation to want to try to understand that which cannot be understood leads to a lot of delusion and a lot of reinforcement of the sense of self. Rather than that sense that things are as they are in this moment, I accept things as they are. And as a result of that, I'm able to then choose how to respond in any given moment. I meaning the collective sense of I, we. And there's tremendous freedom in this. Equanimity offers us this freedom. It protects us from reactivity. And in that protection, there's a certain quality of fear and worry that fall away. So again, I'll just go over that a little bit, that everything that exists exists in and of itself, born of causes and conditions that have occurred already. And this is referred to as resultant karma. And that therefore, to be poised with things as they are, that second function of mindfulness, the capacity to be with things as they are, then allows the freedom of mind to choose based in the exacting sense that begins to occur associated with the distinction between that which is reactive and that which is responsive. And we're able to assume guardianship, a stance of guardianship in the process of that which we cultivate. The term cultivation is extremely important as an aspect of our human process, that there's a very basic principle that wherever attention is what's being cultivated. And equanimity sort of brings certain qualities to a crescendo at an intuitive level that's just able to sense, yes, this is the direction to go. This is the direction to go with the cultivation of mindfulness in this moment. So here the mentalness becomes this active process of being awake with and cultivating that which is born of the response to whatever is occurring. Quite beautiful. Full of hope. The other doctrine associated with the growing understanding that arises with equanimity is very difficult to understand, so relax your need to understand. Okay? Is it relaxed? And just see what of this makes sense to you without chewing at it. It's the doctrine of anatta, the doctrine associated with no self. I have to say that this brings about a memory for me. The first time that a Dhamma student was referred to me by another Dhamma teacher, it was a woman who had heard about the doctrine of no self and just had was terrified, felt hysterical. And this Dhamma teacher didn't know what to do with this woman, so he sent her to me. And so it was a very sweet experience. You know, upon the listening and upon the caring attention, it was about the fact that all my life I've tried to become a self and a good self. I've been the wife of a minister and I've done good deeds. So what was I doing if there's no self? Was everything for naught? Anatta. And it was very, very easy to bring about the softening of that fear, because nothing is for naught. That there was a wise cultivation occurring throughout your life. But meanwhile, that which you cultivated has taken the form of certain qualities that are resonant within your being. You don't have to be worried about them. They have strong karmic influence. And it really is just about a shift in perspective. And so suddenly she was interested. It was okay. What kind of shift in perspective? Well, you know, okay, let's just... And from there was no fear. And actually, this woman became a very, very devoted practitioner in her 80s and died in her early 90s, very much at peace. Very much what I refer to as an anatta deva. Just one who really was at peace as a result of that deep insight. So we hear about this no-self business, and actually what it is a, as I said, a shift in orientation. And it's something that can't really happen by making a decision. It's more that it's kindred to what I've been referring to as that shift in orientation from that perspective born of I, me and mine. You know, I have to do it. I, yai. That song of self. You know, that sense of me, you know, okay, I got it, you. You know, and just that need-born orientation. And that shift from that relaxation of that slow and gradual dismantling of that particular orientation and view in favor of a much more, and again, it comes through insight, which is something that's been occurring for us every moment along the way of our practice, whether it's registered or not. Insight into this process-oriented application of attention that is based in the development of qualities rather than the sense of self. There is anatta in each moment of mindfulness, that surrendered attention that begins to address the cultivation of a wholesome quality. There is anatta in every wholesome quality that we have cultivated. I look at this gradual transition that's happening as the non-crisis-oriented experience with truth. Crisis-oriented approach would be the resistance to things as they are. And so life just keeps having colliding with actuality, right? That willful determination that it's going to be a particular way or that it is a particular way, the denial of actuality. And we've all had this experience of this intricate process by which the mind arranges not to see clearly. Very, very complex. But it can really fool itself into the belief that something is other than the way that it is. And this is one way to look compassionately at the ego construct. It is that willful determination that there is a self. And that willful determination to reinforce that self and to protect it at all costs. And as it turns out, as a result of that, the ego structure is in of itself, in its entirety, a defense mechanism. So this non-crisis-oriented way of opening to actuality, to things as they are, happens very gently through equanimity. Because equanimity is that slow and gentle dismantling of that ego structure, that gentle relaxation of that willful core. And all of the defense mechanisms built up around it. And the re-education of that sense of self and its association with the sense that there is something wrong because of the fact that existence is uncomfortable. And that this uncomfortable experience at an existential level gets resolved around this judgment that there is something wrong with self. So equanimity relaxes all of that. It informs all of this through insight. So it isn't as if there's some tragic death that occurs of the ego. It isn't a demon that suddenly, you know, has blood and gushing from it because its head has been cut off. Finally, the victor. There's so much mythology built up around that. It's just that it's no longer helpful. It's no longer useful. It doesn't provide us with the right information. And so that slowly fades away. And when it reappears in its phantom self, it's just known as empty. It no longer has any power. Another way of viewing anatta, it comes to me in two ways that I actually practice. I went out earlier after dinner and just went as far out as I could, just in the area there, the carport, whatever you call it, and you know, so I could see the sky and to just kind of look up and get a sense of the spaciousness of the sky and to look at the depth of darkness in the sky and to look into the darkness. And I was just noticing that as I looked into the vast darkness, that I was also able to see in that expanse more and more of these little lights, some of them twinkling, you know, some of them yellow, some of them blue, some of them in, you know, the different configurations and so forth, these bodies, celestial bodies. But what I was practicing was really that expansive awareness of the space itself that was being perceived as dark. And just allowing the mind to continue to expand into that spaciousness, into that darkness, into that sense of peacefulness, that, and that perspective that, yes, there is this immense spaciousness in which there are objects that arise and fall away. And that is their nature. And in the clarity of perception that happens over time, there are just moments where one sees, yes, it, this rapid sense of just rising and passing in this immense immensity of consciousness, of space. And so next time you go out to look at the stars, look at the space of what we call sky. Sometimes the mind is referred to as sky, the sky of the mind. The vast sky of the mind. And that space sometimes seems dark at night, varying degrees. Sometimes when during the day it seems to be blue or gray or has clouds, but actually the sky is none of that, nothing that can characterize it. It's just a spaciousness. And there's a sense of anatta in that spaciousness. That yes, truly is empty, but you know what? It's also full. It's full of the awareness that perceives it. Another little anatta exercise, in case you would like to play with it, anatta exercises, is to stand before a mirror. And I do this one too. One of the characteristics of my nature, to a greater degree than now, was vanity. So I used to like to look in the mirror, you know. In fact, I began to realize the reason I liked to look in the mirror is because I didn't feel I existed unless I could see myself. So I keep checking. Do I exist? Oh, yeah. And do I exist in a form that seems to be okay? Yeah, all right, good, all right. Now I can go on and do something. Now I've got to check it out again, you know? And so I'd be walking by and catch the kind of glimpse, you know, of this image in the glass, you know? It'd be, oh, okay, all right, exist, you know? Well, do I exist in a form that seems acceptable? Yeah, okay, all right, you know? It was just that constant sense, this underlying sense of not knowing if I truly existed. And setting a standard for that existence, which was based in appearances. Sound familiar? To some degree. And so it's looking in that mirror. And yeah, it's first thing we're going to see is that physical form. And it's very likely the first take is going to be one of assessment. You know? Aren't we looking in the mirror to assess something? To make sure, I don't know, this piece of hair is... There it is, okay, right there. Oh, good, ready for the day. You know, or is there, you know, anything where it shouldn't be? You know, am I all right? Well, okay. But then, if we just acknowledge that part of it too, that assessment mind, and then if we just kind of look at the form itself, you know, all right, there it is, the face, the countenance. And then if we look just slightly to the right and left, if we relax our attention, then we begin to notice that the mirror is actually reflecting everything else within its view, so to speak, and its reflective power. And so we can actually expand our view to include a lot of the objects that are in the space with us and begin to recognize, oh, this continence is just one object amongst many. The sense of self standing here with this assessing mind is just one object amongst many. And then if we relax the view even more, we can begin to see just that sense that the mirror is actually empty. It's just by its nature, just reflecting whatever is there, whatever is. And in that, there's a sense of anatta, the emptiness that contains everything, including this body, including this mental process, including everything in an all-inclusive awareness. In fact, as we cultivate mindfulness, the power of that process occurs because of the cohesive quality of mind that arises that I've referred to, and its nature is reflective. And so that second foundation of mindfulness that is an expression of this equanimity and this capacity just to be with things as they are, it's just very much like that mirror. And the expanse of consciousness that begins to occur, that opening, you know, with that pleasant and attending feeling of calm, is just the increasing expanse and degree of that reflective consciousness that just is able to see things as they are in ever greater fine detail until it just sees through, it penetrates through to the inherent emptiness present within everything. This is the power of our practice. It helps us to discover that which is. It invites us into that state of mind, that perception, and allows for us to live with increasing degrees of ease, of well-being, free from that tension born of clinging, clinging and craving, because they simply relax. So perhaps we can just continue our practice in this moment from a very relaxed attitude of equanimity. Just being with things as they are in this moment. Just that sense of receptivity. No need to change nor to control. And therefore, just seeing that need as separate, as in fact imposing itself, just seeing it for what it is with compassion. Or the more direct method of cultivating equanimity, to engage the equanimity bhavana, the upeka bhavana, the direct cultivation of equanimity through the Brahma-Vihara practice. This acknowledgement that, yes, I am the owner of my karma. Karma being that which arises in the mind, that which arises through speech, is expressed through speech, and this process that's occurring within this body that leads to deeds and conduct. That I am present within this experience of responsibility, willing to assume complete responsibility for that that arises in the form of those three karmas. I am the owner of my karma. Happiness and unhappiness arises with my actions. So easy to begin to recognize that. Pain with the unwholesome. Freedom with that which is wholesome. I am the owner of my karma. Happiness and unhappiness arises with my actions, and not outside causes. All the causes are present here within this body and the six sense doors. I agree to be present. I am the owner of my karma. My happiness and unhappiness arise with my actions, and not outside causes. Very powerful, very clear. Allowing it for its power to be in its simplicity. I am the owner of my karma.